Hey, what up? It's your boy, Doug Gottlieb. You can check out the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays, 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 3 Pacific, on Fox Sports Radio or the iHeartRadio app. Hope you're having a great day. Thank you so much for downloading this podcast. Look, we tackle all kinds of basketball topics, and I will share with you my thoughts on upcoming weekend's games and some of the things with the Houston Rockets that I love, the Lakers, blah, 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 blah. But this particular All Ball is about youth basketball, something that I grew up playing and that's expanded where everybody's on an AAU team. There's tournaments every weekend and everybody's got a program. And when I did the Kobe podcast, I may not have been, that's not forthcoming. I was pretty forthcoming, but I kind of glossed over how I came to start back up my program and kind of my father's image, if you will, in Orange County. We're only really in year two, and I did it for a couple reasons. One, I did it for legacy's sake, and two, I did it because I like coaching ball and I like teaching kids a certain way. The gentleman who was running a program, still running his own program, who was coaching in Newport Beach, is a guy named Shay Frazee. And Shay, he'll tell you his story. He's a former college basketball player, and he's a great workout guy. Great. And what we found is we have kind of not opposing philosophies, but I start at one place and try and end at another place. He starts at one place and tries to end at kind of a similar place, but they're at opposite ends of the spectrum. It's really interesting. Anyway, here's about a 30-minute discussion on Shay, workouts, youth basketball, and some of the challenges in 2020. And there's also a little discussion there about holdbacks. Now, I am a holdback. I stayed back in eighth grade. It really helped me in my development. I don't believe that every kid should be held back, even though seemingly every kid should be held back. I've talked about holding back my own son, not necessarily with my wife, but because I don't think she's all that hip to it just yet. But it's going to depend upon, I think, his level of seriousness in the sport. And it's not just seriousness in the sport, but you also have to be honest with yourself and with your kid if they have a shot. You know, you got to look at your kid and he's like, well, I want to play Division I basketball. Like, okay, well, you're going to be 5'8 and you're just not good enough. Like, let's be the best basketball player we can. And maybe we go and become a coach if you really love the sport. The same thing could be true. Maybe you're I talked about Josh Elliott's a longtime friend of mine, used to work together at ESPN. And he would talk about Michael Phelps. And he said the most amazing part about Michael Phelps is 6'5", 6'6", white guy. And somehow he found swimming, which was not just perfect for his body type, because he doesn't really have long arms. He has big hands, but he has this long torso. So he found the perfect sport for his body type and his personality. And it just worked. He became arguably the greatest swimmer of all time. So I think that's the other challenge. Many of you have kids that want to play basketball, but maybe they're not that good. Stay is a hard year. It's a hard thing. You're going to separate your son or daughter from their classmates, from any of their friends, maybe for a year, maybe for the rest of their scholastic time. But it can also open up a ton of doors for them in the future. It did for me. More on that to come. Here's my interview with Shay.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
All right, let's bring in Shay Frazee, who we discussed a little bit in kind of the Kobe pod. And Shay, you grew up playing, what, in the Seattle area, right?
Actually, I grew up in Alaska, Doug. I lived in Alaska until I was like 17.
Where in Alaska?
Fairbanks. In fact, I don't know if we discussed this.
Yeah, my dad used to. Yeah, he used to have Team Alaska,
yeah,
right?
100%. Your dad recruited me to come down to Southern California and play on one of his Ranch West teams when I was like junior, going into senior year of high school.
Did you do it?
I didn't. I wish I would have. Actually, I didn't know the landscape. You know, like being in Alaska, you know, you're kind of you're not really privy to the, you know, the kind of the grassroots mecca that Southern California is. And I had already committed to the double pump camp. You know, the camp they used to run where,
yeah,
you could sign up as an individual and go.
Yeah.
And so I had like a conflicting deal. And, you know, in hindsight, I wish I would have gone with your dad, because that seemed to be a better way to get get the job done and get some looks for college. But, you know, it is what it is. Your dad was a really cool guy. He came up there every year. I know he recruited. Did you know that Ray kid that was like the 7-footer that played on Wasilla?
Yeah.
I know he was like one of the kids that was well known to come down to Southern California with your dad.
Yeah, there's also a kid who played at Santa Barbara. I'm trying to think. He played at UC Santa Barbara. Man, all these names are familiar to me because I helped coach kind of some of those teams when they came down to the lower 48. But he would go up there, and he would. It was Ray Schaefer, right?
Ray Schaefer. That's exactly it. He had a little brother who wasn't quite as big or as talented, but yeah, Ray Schaefer. That is it.
Yeah, and he went. He played. Let's see here.
Oregon.
He went to
Oregon.
Yeah. That's accurate. Okay, so you end up playing where, but then you played in Seattle in college, correct?
Yeah, so I ended up going to, my whole family moved down to Seattle to help out my grandparents my senior year of high school. So I played 1 year at Redmond High School, graduated 2005, played 2 years at Bellevue College.
Sure.
For Jeremy Eggers, and then I transferred to Cal State East Bay. In the, it's like in Hayward. It was Cal State Hayward, formerly Cal State Hayward, about 10 minutes south of Oakland, and finished up there in 2009.
Then what?
Then I actually met a buddy, a friend of mine, Charlie Torres. He was playing at East Bay, or he was going to play at East Bay, and then he ended up leaving like right before the season started to play professionally in Mexico. We stayed in touch my 2-3 years that I was there finishing up school. And he invited me to come down to Southern California and start helping him with some skill development stuff in 2011. He had been working with Derek Williams, Arizona, and ended up being the number 2 pick in the draft.
La Mirada High School, just for people.
Yeah,
it's funny. I was
so
just talking to Bobby Hurley. He went to see. He has a kid who signed at Pacifica High School, and they play. He said they played La Mirada. I was like, La Mirada. I was like, Derek Williams, dude, you got to know these guys. Anyway, go ahead.
You know, the Suburban League. So me and Charlie were assistant coaches at La Mirada High School, running kind of player development out of the gym after hours. And that was kind of how I got my start in Southern California basketball.
But then you started working out a lot of pros, didn't you?
Yeah. So Charlie had a pretty good following going. Actually, one of the first places we went to when I moved down here was Mater Dei. And we were working out Kate and Reinhardt, Elijah Brown, like Landry Field, the Ware brothers, and there was this freshman kid. I thought he was part of the football team. He was like 6'5", 200 pounds, and he kept peeking his head. This is like the summertime. He's like peeking his head out from behind the curtain watching us work out. And then Coach McKnight comes up to me and Charlie one day and is like, hey, you know, this kid Stanley, he plays the 5 on our team. He wants to jump in your workouts when he's done with detentions. And we were like, yeah, all right, you know, throw him in there. So we start talking to Stan. I thought he was like a senior on the football team who played tight end and like was the big rebounder bruiser 5. We, you know, he ended up being Stanley Johnson, and he was coming off his freshman year, and like that was a pretty cool experience.
Why do you think he hasn't had a better run as a pro?
Oh, that's a tough question, Doug. I think a lot of it has to do, I mean, like, so, and we can get into this deeper later.
Yeah.
A lot of it has to do with the psychology coming out of being an elite high school player and moving into being like a professional when you're playing with men, with seasoned veterans and kind of like in a hierarchy, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Where you're at the bottom of the hierarchy, or even if you come in with a lot of talent and a lot of hype, and I don't know the inner workings and I could be wrong, you still have to, what would you say? You still have to work your way and kind of earn your stripes into the hierarchy.
Sure.
And I think that can be tough. And if you don't hit the right situation, or if you're not extremely strong mentally, and Stan had some, like, you know, Stan's mom, that was a tough one for him, I know. She passed right as he was going into his rookie season.
Right.
And so I think, like, you know, there's probably 5 to 10 things we could bring together to, you know, to kind of figure out why things haven't gone better for him. But, I mean, he's still in the NBA. He's doing his thing in Toronto. He's got to work his way into the rotation. But, you know, just being there is a big deal.
No, I understand. It is funny how we lose perspective. Like, he's in the NBA, right? He was, the seventh pick of the draft or whatever. He's on to his second or third contract. So, if we take the perspective of he was a top 10 pick and McDonald's All-American and he's not a rotation player in the NBA, he would be seen as a disappointment when you consider the fact that what he's made and that he's made it, and there's only 450 guys in the NBA and he's lasted this long, he's actually overachieved based upon anybody's reasonable level of expectation. So some of it's about expectations more than anything. And I think, look, there's a bunch of stuff, right? Like, he never shot the ball all that well. And the league has really become about shooting more than, like, you have to be so spectacularly talented to play if you're not a great shooter. And he wasn't a great shooter. I do think there was always questions about, not his toughness, he's always a tough kid, but the amount of work, and I think that comes from shooting, right? Is was he really a worker? Then you factor in that he didn't stay at Arizona long to really kind of develop his game. Then his mom dies, and he's a really thoughtful person. Like, he's not like a basketball savage that doesn't affect him. It does. And then he was in a place like Detroit, which is totally foreign. They lost a lot. He'd never lost before. Like, all of these things kind of culminate, and he hasn't been able to break through. And the most success he saw in Detroit was when they finally moved him to the four, which is kind of interesting because, especially talking to you, because, you know, like, when he was in high school, he was a point guard, right? Like, he'd bring the ball. When they needed a bucket, they had Spencer Friedman, but he would bring it up, and he would be the point guard when they needed a bucket. And you go from that, everybody wants to play down a position, thinking that's what you have to do the higher the level you play. But now, as basketball has kind of evolved or maybe devolved, now at 6'5", you can play the four.
No, I think you're right on, like, a lot of those counts, Doug. Like, you know, you named 5 to 10 things that really factored into Stan's ability to be successful as he'd like to be in the NBA. And, his senior year at Modern Day, he did play point guard, and he handled the ball, brought it up the court. They didn't have Spencer yet. He came in the next year.
My bad, yep.
But they had a solid team around him and guys that could shoot and space it for him to get downhill. His freshman year, he played the five, and he kind of worked his way backwards toward the one by his senior year.
Right.
But speaking about, like, the style of basketball that's going on right now, you know, I think four was successful for him in Detroit because he's playing in the middle of the court, and you're playing off closeouts for the most part. Mm-hmm. Either playing on the side off the closeout or in the middle off the closeout, and guys are recovering to you, guys are rotating to you. And you're not doing as much coming off the wing or standing around in the corner, just having to wait for the ball to catch and shoot, which I think, you know, I'd be speaking for Stan right now, but I don't think that was his favorite thing to do. And that's the thing that, like, these young wings coming into the NBA, I was just talking about it with a buddy last night who's probably going to do some pre-draft stuff for BDA this coming summer.
BDA is Bill Duffy, by the way, for people who are listening.
Yeah. And, we were just talking about kids coming in and having to, instead of looking at Paul George and Kawhi Leonard and who they are now, looking at Paul George and Kawhi Leonard as who they came in the league and how they developed into who they are now, and taking the steps one by one and being, like you said, a big-time shot maker who can defend, and then working your way from that role into, you know, whatever you're going to be at the top end. And, you know, if you end up being Robert Covington, like, he might be the most coveted player in the NBA right now. He's 7 teams every week. We're trying to trade for Robert Covington, and there's nothing wrong with that.
It's a great point. Okay, so what I wanted to have you on for, you and I had discussions in the past about basketball at the developmental level. And when you and I first met, I saw your workouts, and I had the people I talked to, you know, like, I knew Landry Fields really well. And Landry's like, dude, Shea is awesome. He is just great workout guy, like, really understands the nuances of how to get a shot and how to use your body. And so I watched you with younger kids, and you and I were talking about passing and pivoting and some of the kind of the fundamental stuff. And it's interesting because there's a bunch of layers to it. One, You know, summer used to be about develop. Like summer is where young kids used to develop. Used to go to basketball camps and used to develop. Now, so, almost every basketball camp is just a moneymaker, and very few focus on fundamentals. And then now, when we do basketball during the quote basketball season, which really lasts all the rest of the year, even that is more about a lot of it is about more. You know, make finishing moves, finishing shots, different types of footwork. Whereas I feel like, and you tell me because you've been actually doing this longer, more recently, like I coached my dad's AAU programs going back to when we talked about, you know, Team Alaska. This is like in the early 2000s. And then there was a 10-year span where I was, and that was high school kids. With young kids, what do you think the biggest challenge is in terms of developing them fundamentally?
That's a big question because there's a big span of youth. There's a big span of youth levels. So you have 8-year-olds who are extremely coordinated and can do almost all the passing, catching, pivoting. They have an idea of how to break the press as a team. They can dribble through a press if they need to, and they can shoot threes. I think in a lot of ways, kids are more skilled and developed than ever. And then you have the rec level. And, you know, that's what we were dealing with down in Newport. When right. Me and you were kind of coaching together and doing some skill stuff together in Newport. It was like right between rec and kids getting into the new club-level basketball. You know, club-level basketball, I'm sure, when you were a kid, was like the best of the best kids.
Yes.
And now club-level basketball has become just one step above rec basketball. And anybody who gets serious at all, they start to play club basketball. So I think at the level that we were working at, I might have been doing things that were advanced for a solid portion of the kids. My philosophy on that level that we were working with at that time was, okay, so there's a one shining moment that kids get when they do something new for the first time, and that moment is like, how would you put it? That moment is exacerbated when they do it in a game or in competition. And so a lot of times when I'm trying to develop somebody's passion for basketball, which is kind of like how I've worked, and you know, maybe not everybody has that, you're looking for those one shining moments and the dopamine hit that makes them feel really, really good about what they just did. And so an example I can give you from our time down there is Max Rogers. You remember Max?
Sure.
So, you know,
I just saw him play yesterday.
Did you? How's Max doing?
He's doing well. He has the move you taught him. You taught him it's like a pass fake to the left and like a sweep to the right. And I'm telling you, like, for a year, that was his, and it worked like every time. Now, my thing was, I was always like, hey, Max, you know, there's this thing on your left arm. It's a left hand. How about we use that every once in a while? And now he's going both ways. Yeah, he doesn't play for me, but he's doing really, really well.
Nice. So, yeah, Max, and that was exactly the example I was going to give, was Max has an unstoppable move going right, and he can make a reverse layup off of a little, you know, sidestep or euro step or whatever you want to call it. And to me, that's the fuel that keeps Max going in basketball. And because he knows that, he'll be willing to take some hits in terms of learning what you would call the more mundane skills of pivoting and passing and jump stopping and the basic things that everybody has to learn and are definitely the most fundamental things, but that nobody really likes to drill out in that way. I don't know. What do you think, Doug?
I think that's a great. You're working backwards. I love that. Right? It's like, look, let me show you the cool stuff, and then let's kind of. Whereas I was always, and this is where I even run into this with my own son Hayes, where he's like, Dad, we do this passing and pivoting every day, and I was like, yeah, because you can't do the fun shit unless you do this. Whereas your philosophy, which is a very interesting one, is working backwards. It's give them the one thing that keeps them coming to the gym, and while you're there, you sprinkle in the other stuff that makes it hard to teach. But right, it's a really interesting way of learning. I think there's a bunch of levels to it. some of it is, you know, it's like I personally want to give like my own son different experiences, playing for me, not playing for me, playing in with teams that play high level tournaments where they press and they pressure, and it's a little bit more frenetic. It's maybe uglier, but it does test kind of their toughness, and it speeds them up, because what happens is I feel like when they play that rec level or against the lower level, the speed is so much slower that they're able to get away with things you can't really get away with when you play real basketball. So it's a very hard thing. I also find that when you get them and they're in sixth or seventh grade, and I even had this a little bit in fifth grade, is you're plugging holes in their fundamentals, right? No one taught them how to help. No one taught them how to screen. No one taught them how to read a screen, even if it's, you know, off a ball screen, right? They may know against a cone to come off and shoot, but what happens when that guy hedges out hard? They don't know yet. And some of it you can only get when they play games, and you can only get when they get embarrassed in those games, because they got to learn to break a press. So I think it's really hard. This was really kind of the embodiment of my conversation with Kobe, which is how do you teach kids? Because yes, the way in which we were taught was more fundamentals, but the game has evolved some. So I almost never teach post play. I just don't. I do teach finishing shots. I teach them to and what I've done is just when they're practicing shots around the basket, they do it off both feet with both hands, all different sorts of angles. And it's just about volume of makes around the basket with either hand. But how you teach them, like, I think you do an incredible job of teaching guys the different footwork it takes to get those shots off now, whereas that wasn't the way that I was taught, and it's something that I'm even learning on the fly.
Yeah, well, I think you make a really good point about the style of basketball being different, and how when you play at the at the higher club levels, you're essentially playing, like, both teams are pressing. That's the, you know, in med school, that's like, you know, bio 101, where this is where we're going to vet the kids. And some kids are going to be able to deal with the pressure, and some kids are going to have to figure it out. And, I mean, so there's this thing called Made Hoops, and it's a Nike-sponsored event, and it's 7th and 8th grade players, and it's like all the EYBL teams have their younger teams, and some teams get in, but it's all the best kids for the most part in the country. Every team presses all game long until both teams can break the press and score on it every time, and that's the only time the pressing stops.
Right.
So with that being said, the premium is on making shots, because if you make shots, you get teams out of the press. Being able to handle the ball and be comfortable with the ball with two people on you.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to be calm, or even if you have to pick up your dribble, being able to be calm, pivot, make tough passes, and then finishing downhill or making a decision on the move downhill fast. And I think offensively, if you can do those things and you're comfortable with those things at a fast pace, you can play against pressure and you'll be all right, kind of no matter where you go and use basketball.
Yeah.
And then you work in, you know, what used to be the most important fundamentals of, you know, making a catch on the wing with somebody denying you, reading a down screen, reading a ball screen. But those things don't even come into play really at the higher levels of youth basketball until you can break the press and be comfortable playing at a really high pace.
It's a great point. I do this drill, and so my dad used to do something he called escape drill, which was you would have three defenders, two guys, and he'd throw you the ball, and you had to break the two guys, but break it on the dribble. He was big on you break it on the dribble. Don't break it on the pass, because you have to learn to break it on the dribble. You break it on the dribble, and then the second the third defender comes at you, that's when you find your teammate, and your teammate has to also find the opening. So what I do I put them in half of the court, And I give one guy the ball, put two defenders on there, and I say, you got 30 seconds. The defense can double team you, do whatever you want, and all you have to do is dribble the ball and not lose it for 30 seconds. And almost none of them are able to do it because they still, but you watch, they get better and better. I agree with you. And you know what? Here's what's funny. I did Arizona State USC on the weekend. And USC dominated the first half, up 13 the first half. In the second half, they didn't finish on a couple two-on-ones, but Arizona State basically got back into the game and won the game. They did not make a field goal for the last 11 minutes until the very final shot. They won the game because they basically pressed, run and jump press, the entire second half on makes, and USC just kind of shit the bed and couldn't consistently break through the pressure. They turned the ball over 24 times, and I was like, this is what it's like to coach AAU basketball, right? Where either you break the press and you make them pay, and you have to score against the press, or they're going to keep pressing you, they're going to crank it up, and this is what happens.
And 100%, that is exactly what happens out there. And it'll be half court, it'll be full court, but they keep coming, and it's not until you can slow the ball down and control the game. It's until you score on the press and show them that you're going to score, like you're going to damage them for taking the risk of putting the backside, in a 4-on-3 or a 3-on-2 or whatever it is. Yeah, that's a really good point.
Yeah, and then it's hard because you have. If you have, especially like suburban kids, regardless of race, you have suburban kids, like they're just not used to, you get some kids that are just dogs and they're going to, and you know, especially AAU games, they can only call so many fouls. They're not going to call a foul every time, you know, and either you're going to compete and you're going to, you know, fight fire with fire or you're not. Do you have a way in which you teach kids how to break pressure?
I basically do what you do, Doug. I don't think there's reinventing the wheel out here. So I run a non-traditional education option for kids, like, you know, fourth to eighth grade, mm-hmm. who want to specialize in basketball. So every single day we play 1-on-2 in a, like, you know how a big full court will be cut into two smaller full courts?
This is what I do. Yes, we don't play one, but I like that.
Every single day we play 1-on-2 because, one, I think, like, we can dribble through cones and everything, but you're not going to get the variance of ball handling skills and the contact and, like, the necessity of using your shoulders and hips and footwork and splitting and all the different things that you get in a 1-on-2 situation. Mm-hmm. And like you said, you can see them, and I have them try and score because, like, a 1-on-2, if you do a good job of it, it ends up being like a pick and roll with someone chasing you from behind, right, when you're playing against a big. So I try and have them score, and one, it helps defensively because kids don't know how to make a box and keep a box. Mm-hmm. And when they get good at it, they can talk to each other like, you know, hey, get over on that side, or they get beaten. They're like, hey, take me on the other side. And the other one has to, you know, run all the way back to cut off and recreate the box. And then offensively, like I said, there's nothing like it for your ball handling. There's no drill I can give a kid that's going to help them as much as 1-on-2.
That's awesome. If you could change one thing about youth basketball, what would it be?
If I could change one thing about youth basketball, it would be, how would I put it? This is going to sound silly. I would change the compartmentalization of the levels. So, right now, the elite high school players only play against each other, and they're separated from the college players and the pro players. And I think youth levels are at the lowest youth levels, rec, club, and the elite players, it is what it is, and it's going to be fine. And you have the vetting system of the speed, but I think that vetting system is a good system. And I think players are more skilled and more developed than ever as far as their shooting and ball handling and decision-making on the fly. If I could do anything like carte blanche, I would create a kind of like the G League, but I would create tiers to the G League where it went all the way down, almost like a European pro system, to where you could have kids that were, 14 is a stretch, but we're talking like 15, definitely 16, 17, 18 years old, mixing in with older players, all the way up to, you know, what we think of as college players, 22, 21, 22, and then even some of the lower-level pros, 23, 24, or guys that are in the G League. And I shouldn't say low-level pros because the G League is really good.
Yep.
And I think that would take care of a lot of the psychological issues that plague grassroots basketball at the amateur level. I don't think it's possible, but that would be like if I could snap my fingers and do anything, that's what I would do.
It's interesting. I don't hate the idea, the vetting part of the pressure, right? Because it's funny. I have daughters that ride horses, and my son, one, he plays football, he plays baseball, and believe it or not, like for basketball parents who are listening, it is all the same. It's like, my daughter who rides, you know, there was a time in which she was tentative about bigger horses or horses that are a little bit too fast, so they can take off on you. And I was like, look, it's okay. If you're scared, okay. And we use the term scared as a complete, always a negative term, but there's no real other way to describe. You want to use a lighter term like hesitant, you know, whatever. If you're scared, you're hesitant. Scared is okay. Like you're scared. You have fear. If you have fear, everybody has fear. Like even the best riders are afraid, but it's how you process that fear. If that limits you from doing what you know how to do on a horse in a show, well, then there's just nothing. There's nothing we can do. There's no coach who can magically do it. In baseball, if you're scared of the ball, right? If you're scared of the ball, at some point, there's nothing we can do. You know, I can take you to the greatest hitting instructor there is. I can take you to the greatest coaches. You know, get you the best bat, get you the best batting gloves, get you an elbow pad, whatever. If you're scared of the ball, doesn't matter. Okay, you can't play high-level baseball because that shit's coming in at 90 or it's coming in at 85 and it might look like it's coming at your ear and curve in for a strike. Like no one likes to get hit by a baseball, but either you can process the fear and make you understand what you're supposed to do and do it, or you can't. In basketball, either you can break pressure and play through contact and play against physical competition, or you can't. And if you can't, it's okay, but it's going to limit the level you play it. So it's not that I don't like pressure and physicality defensively. I would say that I think we'd be smarter to limit the use of zone, right? And limit the full court pressure to whether it's the second half or the fourth quarter, just a way in which because some of this is selfish because I know like if I have a group of kids for a month or 2 months and we run offense, we're going to get any shot we want because I know how to teach it. I know how they can move and I can play to their skills. But I also think though that we're look, every team I play against, almost every team, they'll press and then they'll run like a 1-2-2 zone. And even the zones aren't really sound in terms of how they, you know, when you get to playing real basketball where you're covering people, you know, you're covering your area and you're bumping your guy back, all that, they're just pressure in a zone. And it doesn't teach a kid how to guard somebody, how to guard a ball screen or how to play off a ball screen, or how to play off penetration. All of those things that we need, because truthfully, most high level basketball is man to man concepts. We are skipping that and then backfilling once they get to high school or they get to college. That would be my adjustment, is if they're away at the high level, not to eliminate the pressure, but to make it where it can't be the whole game, because, you know, it just kind of just becomes press to a shot, press to a shot, with 1-2-2 zone, you know, one pass into the high post, kick it out. If they, you know, when you rebound, they just kind of trap the basketball. It's not great. And I do think it could be better. And we could some of that skill stuff that you point out, you don't actually even need to teach because they can't use it in a game.
Hey, so let me, on a side note.
Yes.
Doug's horns package for 10-year-olds is an elite horns package. Like when they go, man, you really are getting whatever shot you want. And the kids don't even have to be that skilled yet. It's pretty funny. I've stolen some of that stuff. But no, to agree with you, the zone thing is my least favorite because you don't even have to be good at pressuring to do the zone thing. Before 12U, and even sometimes at 12U, the kids can't throw. I mean, one of your biggest weapons against the zone where they're going to load up on the ball side is the skips,
yep,
and they can't throw them.
Yeah, no, so, that's my problem with my son Hayes is that he now knows that we're looking to skip. You know, the big thing I've changed and different from like my dad or whatever is, you know, now every day we work on getting the lane, jump stopping, looking opposite, but also, you know, and we, you know, fake a pass, make a pass, but we want to throw that skip pass. But my son's just not strong enough. He's just, he's a little 10-year-old, you know, and he's got to get stronger. You're totally right. And, you know, when teams are putting three guys on the ball, you throw it to the skip pass. I mean, it's not even, like you said, a real zone. Anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, it's good. It's and when, you know, on teams that are going to play zone, if you can't skip, you have to play checkers, essentially, and you have to have the cutters and people moving and someone catching it in the middle. And kids like to catch it in the middle like they like to get hit in the back of the head, because all of a sudden everybody's collapsed on them, and a fake a pass to make a pass is about three times harder.
Yep.
They're just not very good at it, and there's no really way to drill it outside of your basic monkey in the middle type drills. That's not getting you a game situation in the way that you need it. And so, like, zone is, I agree with you, zone is really the worst, because it's a, if there was, and I'm not a big fan of regulating play.
Yeah, I know.
It sucks to even think about, but that would be the one thing that I definitely agree with you. The pressing, all the best presses that I see from elite youth basketball end up being man-to-man run and jump style presses. A lot of the good teams figure out how to beat zone presses, because they figure out that, you know, that checker style pass, 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 or their guard is good enough to just like run straight through the gaps in the zone. But yeah, definitely the zone stuff, the half court zone. I'm going to sit back and just make your 11-year-old shoot threes and pass it around the perimeter, because no one's good enough to skip it. No one's experienced enough to play checkers.
I have two more. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I have two more for you. Okay. As you said, you do pre-draft, you do out-of-season stuff with NBA players, with collegiate players as well. What's the biggest challenge with those guys? What is, because this is a completely different level now. What is the, and because, as you said, you've been doing it since 2011. Now we're, you know, 10 years into doing it. What's changed the most in this last decade of doing it?
I think I'll take both things, the changes and the challenges. The biggest change is the premium on shot making, and shot making was a big deal in 2011, but it's not what it is now. Like, you know, getting guys to get comfortable shooting threes, trying to get them comfortable shooting threes in games, or especially when they're a transition type player like a Stanley Johnson, another guy I've had recently who's been making that transition to being a higher volume 3-point shooter, Ben Moore, who's like the best cutter and offensive rebounder in the G League right now.
From SMU?
But he's still, from SMU. Mm-hmm. He's still trying to figure out how to consistently get his threes up, and you know, I think he's making progress. But that's one of the biggest challenges, or the biggest changes, is the volume of threes guys have to shoot to play the guard and the wing spot and even the big spot now. But the biggest challenge, I think, is consistent buy-in. And there's so many voices coming at these elite-level players that you walk in guilty until proven innocent in terms of your credibility and your ability to teach, and whether or not what you're going to be having them do is worthwhile. Because a lot of these guys, you know, there's people just like hammering at their doorstep to be the guy that rebounds the ball for them. And so creating rapport and getting them to buy into the ideas that you're bringing to them, and getting them to buy into their individual development outside of the team, outside of what their agent wants for them, outside of what their crew or their family is talking about, and taking ownership of their game, that seems to be consistently the biggest challenge.
Last thing, you said you run it's a non-traditional education program where got kids that want to be great at basketball for 4th through 8th grade. How does that work?
Yeah. So I started it like 3 years ago. Well, we did the pilot 4 years ago, and we had three kids, and we were kind of helping proxy their homeschool and their online public charter school education, and I was doing their basketball training every day. So the next year, we started a nonprofit, and we got a classroom, and we coordinated with a performance coach. And I got two ladies that were actually, one of them was working at the Boys and Girls Club. I kind of recruited her away from the Boys and Girls Club because she's great with programming to help me run the program. And so now we have an executive director and a learning coach who does daily activities with the kids. We have like 30 kids. They show up at 9 a.m. They stay till 4 p.m. They do their education every day like you would have. Kids would have PE. We do 2 hours of basketball skills training. And then twice a week we do performance training. We have a wellness curriculum we run twice a week for 45 minutes where they're learning about, I guess you'd say like mindfulness, like financial literacy, things you don't really have in your core subjects in school. We do some yoga in the wellness. We have projects and like field trips we go on. We went to UCLA, Pacific Design Center, the Grammy Museum. Every year we go to Nike and we do kind of a project where kids read Shoe Dog, do a little project on Shoe Dog. We tour the Nike campus and then go watch Hoop Summit. And then we proxy their education. And we have a lot of different education entities we work with. A lot of them are public online charter schools or correspondence programs where kids go a couple days a week to school and then come a couple days a week to us. And so we have 30 kids now. Mm-hmm. We're growing at a decent clip. We're probably getting close to capacity because, I mean, it's like multi-grade, so we have all sorts of different grades in there. But it's been cool. We have a lot of holdback kids. I know you did that, and I wanted to ask you about that. Your experience of holding back, and you know, kind of the culture of holding back now, and what you think about it all.
So, and this is awesome. So I don't know if we got the idea through Todd Brnovich, and of course Todd's dad Marv was a trainer, and Todd is. Who's now an artist, of course, a former first-round draft pick and starting quarterback with the Raiders. His drug problems have been well-documented, but was he was also a great basketball player. He was one of the first holdbacks in Orange County. Now, okay. I was a holdback. My brother probably should have been. My brother was a March birthday, much like my son, and he was like my son, little and probably a late developer. So my brother graduated high school, had just turned 18, and he had some low D1 offers, and he chose to walk on at UCLA, didn't make the team, and then he ended up playing as a walk-on at Drake for a couple years, going back getting his degree from UCLA, and has been a college basketball coach ever since. I knew I was going to be held back in eighth grade. It was a big fight, honestly, between my parents and between my dad and the district in the city of Orange. But he just like, look, this is, my dad grew late and he wasn't big, but he's like, I develop late. My kids are going to develop late. This is what I want to do. And this is what we're going to do. So, that first year in eighth grade, I was kind of a fuck up because I knew I was going to stay back. Right. I mean, I did school. I did all kinds of stupid stuff. I was like, dude, I'm taking this next year. And it was not a great year for me even with my dad, because here he is, you know, fighting everybody to have me stay back. And yet, I knew I was staying back, so I didn't care. You know, I was just like, I'm gonna do whatever. I stayed back. I grew up in the city of Orange. I went to three different middle schools in the city of Orange. My first year was McPherson, which closed down, and combined with Santiago. And then all those kids went to El Medina High School. I went to Yorba Middle School my third year of middle school, was 7th and 8th, so this is my second year of 8th grade. It was across town, so I didn't really know anybody. That middle school fed Orange High School. And so I went to three different middle schools in 3 years. And if you factor in my elementary school in 6th grade, La Vida, and my high school, Tustin, which we actually went out of district to go to, I was the ultimate school hopper, right? 5 schools in 5 years. And I was, like, I'd be a hypocrite if I said, you know, parents picking out schools for their kids is always a negative. I finished eighth grade the first year. I was 5 feet, a half inch, 105 pounds. And when I started high school 15 months later at Tustin High School, I was roughly 5'9", 5'10", like 125, 130 pounds. So I obviously was a big year of growth. During that year, obviously I trained with my dad. I practiced with Pat Barrett's AAU team, which had Jason Hart and Shea Cotton. It was the best. I think they were seventh graders at the time. And then I played with a team out of Compton. I think it was called B-Ball or Team LA or whatever. And I played in an eighth grade league in like downtown LA. And then I played in some Orange County league, you know. And that's what I did to stay back. And look, after my sophomore year, going into my junior year, I went to ABCD camp and I was okay. I was being recruited by mostly mid-majors, the Western Kentuckys of the world. But you fast forward to a year later. So if I had graduated at 18, like everyone else, I would have been a mid-major to maybe, you know, a Washington State type of player. Instead, I was recruited by everybody, you know, UCLA, UConn, Florida. I chose Notre Dame or whatever. And I was on the Magic's All-American game as a replacement for Chauncey Billups. I was, you know, one of the top 50 players in the country. And I graduated at 19 years old. Additionally, I thought it really helped me, not just in terms of the level of scholarship, but my ability to play right away. And here's why. I graduated high school at about 155. I was 160 when I arrived at Notre Dame. I was 177 for my first game at Notre Dame, you know, creatine, weightlifting, whatever. But part of it is like your body goes through a different process of maturing. First you grow, and then you got to get those man muscles. Even if I was recruited at a high major level at 18, my body wouldn't have fully developed until my sophomore year. So I probably wouldn't have played very much. Whereas now I started 4 years in college. Now, because I transferred and then sat out another year at Golden West, I finished college at 24. But, you know, so that might hurt you for the NBA or something because you're like, they feel like you're fully developed. But yeah, for the right kid, especially a late bloomer, I'm a proponent of most kids. And my, you know, it's a discussion we've had about my own son. And the hard part is your friends are going to go on and go to the same high school and you're probably not. And that's the only real negative to it is if you grew up in one area with one group of kids playing. I still play in the same AU team for my dad. And I'm just, you know, by my senior year, we had new guys, but I grew up playing with Miles Simon and J.R. Henderson and Kriston Johnson. They all went and played in college. And then I had one more year of high school.
Yeah. I mean, it's the standard now really. And I think you're right. A lot of the times it should be used for, you know, kids, the right kind of kid who's developing late. I think now it's a tool that's used almost exclusively for confidence. I mean, like late development is a byproduct, but the confidence that it gives kids going into their freshman year, bigger, stronger, faster, having dominated eighth grade if they went through it a second time, or even having played better in eighth grade if they weren't a dominant player to begin with. People just really, they do well with that. And if you look at Devin Askew, who actually reclassed back to his original class, same thing with Nico Mannion at Arizona, reclassed in eighth grade and then re-reclassed from his junior year, in his junior year back to his original class, people are having a lot of success with it. And I think it's going to start to spread out, you know, move throughout the country. Even though it kind of started in this area, like you said, with Marinovich.
Yep.
And I knew about it from Mike Garrity, who did it kind of infamously at Mater Dei.
Yeah.
He came in and started as a freshman.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's almost the standard now.
Do you know what number Mike Garrity wore?
What number did Mike wear?
44. Do you know why?
Was that you too, Doug? Were
yeah.
you 44?
Yeah. Mike was like a little shit, like four, I don't know, he was like maybe sixth grade or whatever, but he was tiny. And he used to come to our workouts. We used to do workouts Sundays at Woodbridge High School. And Mike would show up and his dad would drop him off and he'd work out with the high school freshmen, eighth graders, whatever. And he would stay and he would just try and hop in whenever he could. And yeah, now he's become, you know, then he obviously played in college and now he's a workout with Cleveland in the NBA and is unbelievable what he does. So yeah, so it's really interesting the ties that bond. Hey, look, how can somebody who is interested in your program get a hold of you or learn more about what you're doing?
So for my training or my skill development stuff, you can go to frazeeskills.com. It's F-R-A-Z-E-E skills.com. For the non-traditional education program, it's called ABA, Above and Beyond Academy. That's at abanation.com. And so, yeah, that's where you can reach me.
Shay, it's great to catch up with you, dude. I'm glad we got to do this. Let's talk more offline. And the best part is we both have a total passion for not just the sport, but the kids in the sport. And I really appreciate you joining us in the All Ball podcast.
Hey, Doug, I appreciate you having me on, man. It's great to talk to you. You know, I'm basketball lifers like you and me. There's nothing better than that. And, yeah, let's get Hayes out there to a workout sometime soon. I haven't seen him in a while.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific.
All right, that's it for All Ball. I hope you enjoyed that one. A little bit different, right? Talking youth hoops. We'll continue to do that. I have friends that call me and ask my opinion all the time. Any of you who listen to this podcast, I don't know if that helped you. We want to talk more about UIPL and some of the other stuff coming up and camps. Actually, you know what? We'll do a podcast here upcoming in the next couple of weeks where we'll try and find the best youth basketball camps. Talk about my camp experiences. Some of the times I got in trouble as well. Anyway, thanks so much for listening and for downloading. Always appreciate you being a part of All Ball.